And I'm glad to get back into the book of Leviticus. It's been a while. And so what I've decided to do tonight is kind of do a review of everything I've done up to date. And because there are some who are here tonight who were not here in the beginning. And so this will get everybody caught up to speed, so to speak. Although I can't go back and share every detail. I think that's 12 messages worth. So I'm not going to do that. I had to read all 12 messages, by the way. Which sometimes makes you cringe when you have to go back and read what you have written in your manuscript. And you say to yourself, did I really say that? I can't believe I said that. And so it allows me to correct a few things as well, but nothing major, but it allows me to do that. So what a blessing to be in the book of Leviticus. And while we were in Greece, we were with 65 other missionary families from around the world. And with some friends of mine and some who went on to get postgraduate degrees. And some of those had postgraduate degrees in the Old Testament. And they happened to ask me, well, what are you preaching through? And I said, I'm preaching through Leviticus. And they said, good night. Are you an Iron Man? What are you? And I said, well, I don't know. I wouldn't say I'm an Iron Man. I just had a desire to preach through the book of Leviticus. And they said, well, you're a better man than I am. So I don't know what that says. For some reason, people are afraid to preach through the book of Leviticus. But I've enjoyed it. It has brought a lot of things to life for me as I have done so. And so I just want to get back into the furrow and the trench of the book and just do a review of it. And without any real particular emphasis on any one passage, I'll read a few sprinkling of passages as we make our way through this. But I just want to go back and reemphasize a few things. And really, if I were asked to summarize what the book of Leviticus is about, it's about many things, but to put it in practical terms, everyday terms, it emphasizes the importance of holy relationships. Being first, the holy relationship that we have with God Himself, and secondly, having holy relationships with those around us. Because when you boil it all down, distill it, and get it down to the very essence of what it's about relationships with God and then our relationship with fellow man. And the point is that since the time of the fall in Genesis chapter 3, relationships have been problem fraught, have they not? First, our relationship with God was severed. It's broken. That's why Ephesians 2 says that we are dead in our trespasses and sins. And then our relationships with those around us are very problem fraught. Look how fragile relationships are. It is difficult to build a relationship with another individual, but it is so easy to destroy a relationship in no time flat. What has emerged is that one's relationship with God is the antecedent to right relationships with those around us. And so Leviticus is all about relationship repair. First with God, and then with our fellow man. And in fact, that is even emphasized when you get deep into the book of Leviticus, in Leviticus 19:18, where it says there, you are to love your neighbor as yourself, as Moses addresses his fellow Jews. That's the first that is ever uttered. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus was not the first one to say it. He is simply repeating what is written in Leviticus 19:18. And so it is about relationships. God is not interested in relationships of convenience. He's not interested in relationships of ease. Relationships are not easy. I'm sure they were a bit less problem fraught before the fall, but they sure took a nosedive after the fall. So what God does here is He defines relationships. First, relationship with Himself. and secondly, relationship with those around us, but he does so in the context of his holy character he pervades. What we need to understand is that if one is to have a relationship with God, that relationship will have most be based on his holy character. That is paramount. That's a non-negotiable with God. He's not interested in any run-of-the-mill relationship. A true, a meaningful, and authentic relationship with God is defined by his he is totally other than what we are. He is separate. He is wholly other than what we are, and so any relationship with him will have to be in accordance with his holy character and his holy nature. So what is the basis for such a relationship? Leviticus is a wonderful illustration, a beautiful word picture for New Testament saints of the holy demands upon which a relationship with him is predicated. As we review tonight what we have learned to date, I would like us to reflect holy relationship with God. The first building block that leads to a holy relationship with God is the context of holy relationships, and then we will briefly consider the conduits for relationship repair. The first building block for a holy relationship with God is, number one, the context of holy relationships. For that, just turn back from Leviticus to Exodus 19. This is where we began our journey in January. Exodus 19, I just want to read verses 5 and 6. I'm not going to read it all for the sake of time. But this is in the context of the covenant that God is making with the children of Israel at the foot of Mount Sinai after they have made the trek of deliverance out of Egypt through the Red Sea and into the wilderness. Beginning in verse 5 of Exodus 19, "Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." That are the words, these are the words that you shall speak to the sons of Israel. The context of this holy relationship that Israel has with Jehovah, with Yahweh, as it is in the Hebrew, is rooted in a covenant context that is based in redemption. Chapters 12, 13, and 14. It goes back to the first Passover meal. It goes back to the deliverance that they experienced as they went through those parted waters onto the other side, into the wilderness, and spilled out into that desert region. It is all based on redemption. God is not making a covenant with an unredeemed people. He has chosen them. He has called them. He has delivered them. And now based on covenant with them, that is the parlance we would use in the 21st century, contract. But it's more than a contract, because a contract only implies some kind of a business relationship, personal at the very heart of its nature. Covenant reeks a relationship with these newly redeemed people. He has purchased them out of the literal slave market and the metaphoric slave market of sin. Now, this the covenant that God in Exodus 19. And so the basis for everything you read in Leviticus is rooted and anchored and moored and wrapped up and woven in this covenant relationship that God is making with the nation of Israel, known as the Mosaic Covenant. And so within the context of this holy relationship, we see a people in covenant with God. And that is based on redemption first and foremost. So what are the contours of this covenant? I'm not going to get into all the mechanics and structure that I shared with you. You might remember I said it is a suzerain vassal treaty. Suzerain, king, vassal, meaning with them. This is a binding agreement between a superior and his royal subjects. It was on the basis of this covenant that God then mediates his relationship with Israel. And the primary characteristics of this covenant were, number one, that it is meant to be revelatory. It is a revelation. It is a revelation of the character of Yahweh. Okay, we're going to... But who is it exactly? Relationship, you must share something about with the one that is the object of the relationship. And so God needs to declare about who he is and about what he desires from him. And so the character of Jehovah was revealed through the vehicle and the structure of this covenant. Of God's character, his attributes, and his will. And via the covenant details about God were disclosed. Veiled as he pulls back the curtain on who he is. And his will is going to be declared to them. He does not leave them to their own devices to discover who he is and what he desires from them. He doesn't play hide and go seek. He doesn't relational game. He is on the laws and stipulations that he gives them. And so a covenant is all about revealing who God is. In that whole enterprise, they will learn much about themselves. But it is about revelation. Secondly, a covenant is about relationship. God reveals himself, and based on that revelation, then the relationship deepens. As the threads of the garment are drawn closer together and the fabric of that relationship between Israel and God is now defined. It is going to be delineated. It is described. God will reveal and disclose his expectations. He announces what he desires from them. Much of it is recorded by Moses. It isn't a relationship that is bathed in ambiguity and uncertainty. You can remember as a young man, going through that whole dating process. I look back and I hated that. You liked her, she liked awkwardness, and you get to know her and she gets hold back and she holding back. Relationship. Based on that. And so there's this question mark. Always this security in that relationship. Not so. You can relativistic, subjective twaddle. It's all objective. It's up front. He states who he is and what he expects from them. It is far from a relativistic, make it up as you go along relationship, which has become commonplace in the 21st century today. And God lets them know, when you are in relationship with me, there's take in this. I want you to know, not only is there responsibility, but there is a responsibility, and you are look for this. This was a serious. This wasn't some kind of disposable relationship. You might say God was in it to win it. This is a real deal. It was a relationship circumscribed in responsibility and accountability. And today people crave the undefined, unnumbered, no strings attached, long in a relativistic bubble of raw. But it's about relationship. I am so glad that our God does not leave anything for us to guess about. It's all stated what He wants, what He's about. And so, covenant is about revelation. Relationship, it's a loss. And thirdly, a covenant. If there's going relationship is going to be a well-defined relationship, then there are going to be stipulations. But being impersonal rules gives them 613 laws that are ultimately given to Israel that are put parameters. Relationship. Those who are genuinely redeemed will desire and prize this relationship. In light of these laws, they're not meant to be a burden, but rather a delight of the redeemed. Every law that was given affects the person. That was given reflects the will of God in some measure and in some fashion, even in the sowing of two kinds of seed together and wearing garment made from how to they wanted to know God, they needed to study His law and then seek to apply it by grace in their everyday lives. So the contours of the covenant were revelation of God, a relationship with God, and regulations that enabled all of the above. So those are the contours of this covenant. Secondly, a people in covenant with God, we see their covenant character. We see the covenant character of the covenant people. And in verses 5 and 6 of Exodus 19, "Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the sons of Israel." God outlines three characteristics of this covenant people that are very instructive. Now that they are a redeemed people, is that they are His possession. His possession. And as such, they are immense value to Him. We could illustrate it very easily with the relationship that a father has with his children. as he prizes them. Because a father's children are always in like manner, Israel deemed pride of place with Yahweh. They were this prized possession, according to verse 5. Secondly, they are priest kings. He calls them a priesthood. They were to be priest kings or mediators. Race to the other nations around them. They are elect of God. This is their mission. This should be their goal. This is the purpose for which they mandate. Of their God. Now we know they fell far short of that, didn't they? On many occasions. God's mandate never changed. It is still the same today. We know it is the Great Commission. God has never relented on this. Now we do it based on the name of Jesus Christ. But to that extent, they were to be priest kings or mediators. And thirdly, they were to be a holy people, according to verse 6, where he says, you are to be a holy nation. Not your run-of-the-mill. He meant this comprehensively holy in every act of their lives and every fiber of their beings is to somehow reflect the transcendent, infinite, eternal holiness of the God that they serve. And because they are to be comprehensively holy in every area of their lives, that is going to have bearing on what they eat. It is going to have bearing on what they wear, their fields, and how they slaughter their animals, and how they prepare their food, and how they relate to one another. More importantly, this comprehensive holiness is going to have a direct impact on how they worship Him and how they are to live in light of His holiness. Holiness is to permeate and pervade every single solitary nook and cranny of their lives. The point to this seeming ridiculous exercise was simply this. I mean, okay, what about all of those dietary laws? It seems so pointless. It makes no dietary laws that there was an illustration. Emmanuel. God with us. Even we eat in what we do and in how we govern all of our human relationships and life, Emmanuel, God with us, practicing the presence of Yahweh. That is the covenant character of the people. Prized possession, priest, king, mediators, and they were to be holy as He Himself is holy. And so, they were a people in covenant with God. Secondly, concerning this context of a holy relationship, they were a people who pursue a holy God. They were to pursue Him in holiness. Leviticus brings this out so many times, and I can't wait to get to chapter 11 and chapter 19 and begin to unpack all that is there. But in verse 44 of chapter 11, again, we read, "For I am the Lord your God. Consecrate yourselves, therefore, and be holy, for I am holy. And you shall not make yourselves unclean with any swarming things that swarm in the earth." Point is holiness. in every facet of life and being. Leviticus 19 and verse 2, again, in this very eminently practical section of the book of Leviticus, he says, "Speak to all the congregation of the sons of Israel and say to them, 'You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy.'" And then based on that, he gives a whole litany of laws. This is what it means to be holy. This is what it means to live a holy life. Person God. And the laws, though numerous they may be, and diverse they may be, highlight the comprehensive nature of the holiness of God. Remember what I said early on in this series, that in scriptures, law code for civil administration and civil matters and for civic duty. And then they would ceremonial or religious law. They normally did not have any kind of a moral code that went along with that. But what is so intriguing and so scintillatingly interesting about Old Testament law in the book of Leviticus is all ceremonial and laws and throws it all together. And so, together in the mix, leave that flex, the comprehensive nature of His holiness, and that you can't compartmentalize any aspect of that holiness. And so, these are a people who are to pursue a holy God. And the canvas of themes that this book unfolds are very simple. First, holiness pervades the context. From chapter 1, verse 1, all the way through till the end of chapter 27 of Leviticus, holiness is the simple definition is to be set apart, but it's much more than that. It's much more than taking a religious article that's applied. That's more than consecrating that article for some specific. And being set apart for to someone and to something that is wholly other than what we are used to and can conceive of. And so we are to take on the otherness of the one to which we are consecrated to. This is clearly reflected in the outline of the book. The first 16 chapters simply chapter 27, how to live holy. Said another way, chapter 16, how to approach and access God. Chapter 17 through 27, to our daily, everyday, ordinary lives. The book speaks of a holy God, of a holy people, of a holy nation, and of a holy priesthood. And so holiness pervades the context. That's the primary theme. A second primary theme of the book is atonement. Atonement that points toward holiness. How does one make and maintain this is the age old of atonement effervesced the book, underscoring the means for restoring a fractured relationship with Yahweh. The Hebrew noun for atonement is kofer. And it has the basic idea that some price takes place. The ransom. That is implied in the Hebrew terminology that is used. The substitutionary price is dying in behalf of the tabernacle and offer. On your behalf, that is and once has been temporarily received. But not only is that implied, but in the verb kippur, from which we get, it includes the conciliation. And now some of you, what? Propitiation is this. Substitution the Old Testament was only temporary until you sinned again, but it's there. And the doctrine of atonement is one of the cardinal doctrines. I told my class in the doctrine of salvation that I'm this is ever take in your Bible college career. Because if the doctrine of the atonement, if you get the doctrine of salvation wrong, it's a loss. There is eternity to lose. And hell to gain. It is no wonder why the devil attacks the doctrine of atonement in every church. Radical than others that relate to the doctrine of the atonement, trying to make a substitutionary death of Jesus Christ. Bert Schweitzer taught what is now called the atonement, whereby Jesus Christ was all an accident. Christ in Palestine with a Messiah too far, and things were that he was crucified. He implied in sin to be made. supremely blasphemous, anti-God, Christian, anti-biblical. Atonement of Jesus Christ. There are many doing similar things today. The point is, the atonement is an undergirding theme throughout the book of Leviticus. For without atonement, there is no holiness. A third theme that pervades the book is this: sacrifice. Sacrifice that provides the holiness. When done correctly, with the right heart and the right spirit and the right attitude. That's what we've been looking at over the last months as we've looked at the first six chapters of Leviticus and looked at the five sacrifices that were made. Simply put, a sacrifice is a gift to God that expresses coming to Him, seeking to commune with Him, expressing gratefulness for the forgiveness of sin that one can have on the basis of an animal slain in my place. Now please understand that you couldn't just go through the perfunctory exercise of some sacrifice like the burnt offering. Oh, no. Confession was necessary. Chapter 5 and verse 5. There it says, "So it shall be when he becomes guilty of one of these, that he shall confess that in which he has sinned." There is the confession of sin, the acknowledgement that yes, this is the specific sin that I have committed. That bring this animal on my behalf to make blood atonement in my place to make a forgiveness for this sin. Chapter 16, on the Day of Atonement, verse 21, we read a similar thing. "Then Aaron shall lay both of his hands on the head of the live goat." This is the scapegoat that they let out into the wilderness. "And confess over it all the iniquities of the sons of Israel and all their transgressions in regard to all their sins. And he shall lay them on the head of the goat and send it away into the wilderness by the hand of a man who stands in readiness." Confession on the part of individual confession in chapter 5, verse 5. Now, communal confession on the part of the nation as a whole. Confession had to accompany this. Contrition, brokenness of sin, repentance. And so the place of worship was the tabernacle. The tabernacle was where these sacrifices were made. And underneath the altar of burnt offering, that bronze altar, was a fire that burned perpetually. Continuously. They had to stoke that fire every day because it represented the very presence of God. Important to the whole theme of holiness and atonement. And so that is the context of a holy relationship. Now let me quickly run through the conduits of relationship repair, which we have looked at in chapters 1 through 6. So how did they practically repair a broken relationship with God once they'd sinned? Certainly sin lives and in their walk with God. So how did they get it right when the relationship with Him was disrupted? Through the fivefold system. These are the conduits that would ultimately bring about a holy condition once again. The first is found in chapter 1. It is the burnt offering. I am not going to read all of chapter 1, so don't worry. But that is where we find it. And simply put, the burnt offering was an offering that of the offerer, because the whole animal is consumed on the offering. Is a hand, not both hands, like the high priest does on the Day of Atonement, just substitutionary nature of that offering and sacrifice. Reaches around, slits the throat of the animal, whether it was a ram, whether it was a sheep or a goat, or even doves. Of course, in that case, they just ripped the head off. They reach around and slit the throat. But they laid their hands on it. And it was offered in their place. The point is, it is a very costly offering. It is going to cost the offerer something, his best, his unblemished animal, his prize-winning, award-winning animal. And then the blood is caught in a basin by the priest and is sprinkled and splattered on all four sides of the altar of burnt offering. The whole foundation for this is seeking union with God once again. And it is only through blood atonement. The message that came through loud and clear is very simple. It's illustrated in a pop song from the 70s, I believe. Baby, you're no good, you're no good, you're no good, baby, you're no good. Sin. I am short of the glory of God. Oh, he would make that offer. But here is the meal offering in chapter 2, where they took grain, the finest flour, their best flour. Once again, it is grade A. We're not talking about the generic stuff. We're not talking about the stuff that's on the shelf, past its shelf date. We're talking about the very best prime flour that money could buy. And they would with fragrance, and they would mix that, put some of that meal on the earth, ultimately smell an aroma to God. But it symbolized and displayed the gratefulness and the dedication of the one making the offering to God. And usually this was done subsequently to the burnt offering. It was a way of saying thank you. It's the of sin that I have received of the burnt offering. And so incense is mixed in. Salt was mixed in because it presents made with Israel. Given what's going on in South Africa, you'd have to help. All can be put in bread and in other commodities that we buy. No amount is given here. They just put salt in. The point is, it's a preservative. And it showed that they were holy to Him and that it pleased God. A third conduit is found in chapter 3. It's the peace offering, or known as the peace offering. And the peace offering symbolizes its offering. God for for this animal. Fellowship meal right there in the courtyard of the tabernacle. And he would invite friends and family, and they would enjoy this fellowship as they ate that very presence of the King. You see, it was a high and holy privilege to be in of the King and to because of a blessing of offering that one make to God and seal that vow with the peace offering or a free will offering. Miscellaneous blessings. Nothing in particular. We're just done. And the best was always given. The best and the abundance of God. It was a celebration. Praise would have been issued around that meal table as worship and communion with one another in the very that is what peace with God. Situation. God is not but it is fourth conduit is the sin offering. Chapter 4. Sin had an effect. It not only the sinner, that was committed in the tabernacle area itself, that was a sin. Follow procedure. Touch the tent. Tent of meeting, and he pulled back that curtain when he should. Sin offering, and they would blood around the on all four sides of the altar of incense in the tent of meeting. Leaders, they had sinned, and so they could atone for sin. And then individuals, all sins of inadvertence, you didn't necessarily commit it, but you did, and after you committed, you said, whoops, what do I do now? There was a way to deal with that. What's interesting is that in chapter 4, the term that is used for sin is used in concentrated is really serious, dangerous. There is age and culture to define deviancy down, is there not? I was in an article for somebody else's blog, which is a lot more popular than my own blog, and dealing with the whole aspect of homosexuality, and so I did that, and were you simply Light of the Nations Church in Pretoria? They listed various vices around that, and then under just pop over. Deviancy down. Book of homosexuality, let's I'm glad we don't have to make sin offerings today, because we would be doing that perpetually in this day and age. And so we must guard against this, and we must realize that sin is certainly serious. The final conduit which would bring about holiness to the nation of Israel was the guilt offering, or the reparation offering, as it was also termed. That's chapter 5. Down through verse 7 of chapter 6. And so he details what the guilt offering is all about. Now, the guilt offering dealt with or defrauded in or where one had defrauded the, as verses 1 through 7 of chapter 6. And so one could defraud related to the tabernacle. Frost. One sometimes one wasn't quite sure what they had done. They just had a nagging sense about them that they'd done something wrong. As a kid growing up, I had that 24/7. I was always in trouble. In fact, I was the one most likely voted not to succeed in my family. I was the one most likely to occupy a jail cell someplace. I was always in trouble. And even when I wasn't in trouble, I had this nagging sense, what have I done? Man, did I this? Did I do that? No. Well, if that happened to you, what you had done, you could go to God and you could make this. You could pay the and add 20%. And then when you defrauded your neighbor. And the issue of defrauding the neighbor here is that an oath had been taken, and that oath had been
invoking Yahweh's name. If I went on a to those valuables, I didn't steal them, he could make one neighbor only defrauded their neighbor, but there's double God's name as well. The sacrifice was made. Restitution is made to the neighbor. Sacrifices made to God. Plus 20% to the neighbor and plus 20% to God. And so there was a way to deal with those broken, severed. What Victor Matthews, the Old Testament scholar and commentator, has to say on this. He said, a true signal of a regenerated heart is the way in which commitment to Jesus changes our behavior toward others. Reparation is made. And where reparation and restitution is possible, it should be made. Again, let me read what he said again. A true signal of a regenerated heart is the way in which commitment to Jesus changes our behavior towards others. Changes our behavior towards them, first and foremost. It changes our as number one. As the pinnacle of creation. It changes our relationship to our world around us. We no longer have the same relationship with the things of the world. They are but passing fancies, fleeting fancies. We're in the world, but we're no longer of the world. It changes our relationship. We don't live simply. Simply seeks to eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we may die. It changes our relationship. Our spouses, children, to our employees, our church. Relationship with is how the Old Testament saints had to deal with these holiness issues. Aren't you glad that we live on this side of the Jesus paid it all to Him I owe. Let's pray. Father, I thank You again. I thank You for a book that, from our vantage point of the 21st century, seems mysterious. It seems so foreign to us. That one would think there is absolutely no application for us today. And yet, as we have taken the time to roll up our sleeves and to dig in and to look at what Your Word has for us from the book of Leviticus, indeed, I am amazed. And I pray that we're all amazed. The riches, the depth, and the truth that reside in this text. How it serves as a wonderful word picture with all of its various definition. Kaleidoscope of color pointing to the risen one. To the one who trod and made his way to Mount Calvary. To the one who became the ultimate sacrifice. The ultimate substitute. Who finalized atonement for all. The one who spilled his blood and voluntarily gave up his own spirit in death. The one who suffered the ravages of the penalty of sin, past, present, and future, when the wrath of the Father was poured out on him for that brief moment in time. Father, I thank you that that is our touchstone. I thank you that we live in the shadow of the cross.